Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to delve into a murky area of medicine, an area of medicine that we've not covered before on Intelligent Medicine. It's an area that is really poorly defined, even among conventional doctors. It's poorly understood. It involves a condition that, in one form or another, affects perhaps tens of millions of Americans. It's very common, but it's very elusive. The condition is dysautonomia. And if you don't know what that term means, you're going to know a heck of a lot more by the time we conclude this interview. Today, we're going to talk to an expert. She's Lauren Stiles. Lauren Stiles is president of something called Dysautonomia International. They've got a website at dysautonomiainternational.org, and it's an amazing organization. It's dedicated to the study and promulgation of information about dysautonomia. Lauren Stiles is an attorney. She has a JD degree, but she herself was afflicted with a form of dysautonomia, and after a relentless two-year quest to find an underlying cause of her symptoms, she was finally diagnosed with autonomic neuropathy caused by an autoimmune disease, Sjogren's syndrome. And since founding or co-founding Dysautonomia International in 2012, she's been an outspoken advocate for individuals living with autonomic disorders. And we're going to find out more about it with her today. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine. It's a pleasure having you aboard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, well, help us with a definition of dysautonomia. And this may take us back to, I don't know, high school or college, where we began to study the nervous system.
Right. Well, most people might know this, the autonomic nervous system by its more colloquial name is the involuntary nervous system. You might remember back in, you know, high school learning about there are sensory nerves that control your sense of touch and taste and smell, and then there's motor nerves that control your muscles, and then everything else is the autonomic nervous system. Your heartbeat, your blood pressure, your body's ability to digest food, excretion, sweating, all of those involuntary things that you don't have to think about, that your body just takes care of for you, are controlled by the autonomic nervous system.
Yeah, sometimes when I try to explain this to patients, I point my finger at some object on my desk and say, look, I could do this with great precision. With my forefinger, I can touch the paperweight on my desk. But if you ask me to lower my blood pressure by 10 points voluntarily, I might have some difficulty doing it, although there's some yogi adepts who've right. been studying meditation for years who are able to do this voluntarily. They can raise or lower their skin temperature. They can reduce their breathing rate to incredibly low rates. But that's not something an ordinary person can do. But there's some people in real trouble with their autonomic nervous systems, right?
Right. And when you have a problem with any part or even all of your autonomic nervous system, you would get diagnosed with a form of dysautonomia. Dysautonomia itself is not a specific diagnosis. It's like a class of disorders.
It's a grab bag.
Right. Like cancer is a big umbrella term, and there's all these different types of cancer underneath it. And so dysautonomia is an umbrella term, and there's lots of common and uncommon types of dysautonomia.
Okay, so why is this sort of poorly understood or poorly addressed in conventional medicine?
Well, I've been trying to figure that out for the past 6 years, and I think really there it falls into every discipline of medicine, so it isn't owned by any one department of the hospital, so to speak. You know, autonomic nerves are clearly part of neurology, but the symptoms that they cause, these patients will show up in cardiology when they have blood pressure and heart rate problems. They'll show up in the GI doctor's office when they have gastrointestinal digestion problems. They'll show up in the endocrinologist's office if they're having problems with their various endocrine regulation, which is also partially controlled by the autonomic nervous system. They might show up at the eye doctor if they're having dry eyes because their tears are regulated by the autonomic nerves. So nobody really owns autonomic disorders. You know, it's not like, everybody knows, you know, if you're having rheumatoid arthritis, joint pain, you go to the rheumatologist. So dysautonomia patients, we don't really have one specialty we can go to. And I think sort of, you know, no discipline wants to own the illness because it's so complicated. Once a patient has a widespread dysautonomia, they really do get symptoms all over their body.
And here's an alternative theory, which is that since dysautonomia predominates in women, I think that there are statistics that show that. Certainly men are not exempt from it. These diverse symptoms sometimes get attributed to hypochondriasis, neurosis, somatization, depression, anxiety, and they get dismissed or they get treated simply with anti-anxiety medication or antidepressants. I mean, am I not alluding to something that's real?
Yeah. So there are all different forms of dysautonomia, and some of the more common forms that occur in young people are very female predominant, specifically postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS. But the types of dysautonomia that can occur in the elderly can go with Parkinson's, can go with diabetes, long-standing diabetes. 25% of diabetics will develop autonomic neuropathy, and that's probably the highest, you know, riskiest form of diabetes to have because it's associated with an increased risk of death. People with MS can have dysautonomia. So, but the younger female patients who are getting POTS tend to right away, as soon as they get sick, they have a lot of symptoms. And, you know, a young woman who looks totally normal goes to the doctor, and it's not uncommon for these patients to be told, you know, you're just nervous. In my own case, I was a happily married, very well-employed attorney, and I got sick after a concussion. And the very first doctor that I saw in the emergency room the day after the concussion told me I was just hungover. Mm-hmm. And then I said, yep. No, I haven't had any alcohol. And the very second thing he said to me is, well, then you're just having a panic attack.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't have any history of that, but so we've actually surveyed the POTS patient population, and we found that 85% of POTS patients have been given some kind of psychiatric or dismissive diagnosis, being told by a doctor it's all in your head.
Right.
And so we try to, you know, it's very frustrating for patients, but I think the best way to deal with it is to try to educate the public and educate physicians and kind of not... try not to be so angry about it. Just understand that it comes from the lack of education on the topic. We have to educate.
So there's a position of advocacy on the part of Dysautonomia International to put this condition front and center in the medical diagnostic armamentarium, so that both patients will be forearmed with a sense that this could possibly be a dysautonomia-related condition, and its physicians will have a heightened awareness of this.
Yeah, we've been doing physician education courses throughout the U.S., and we're very blessed to have a medical advisory board that has most of the top dysautonomia doctors in the U.S. and Canada are part of our organization or working with us closely. And there aren't that many of them. It's a pretty small world of autonomic experts. But we're hopeful. We're seeing some progress. We actually launched Dysautonomia Awareness Month. You know, a lot of diseases have an awareness month that they try to heighten their exposure. So we started doing that in 2012. And then last year, it really took off. We had a huge billboard in Times Square was donated to us by NASDAQ.
Wow.
And giant billboards up in Boston on the major highways were donated by MassDOT. It was really neat. And we light up things turquoise. That's our awareness color for dysautonomia.
Turquoise ribbons, too?
Yep, ribbons. We lit up Niagara Falls turquoise.
Wow.
We lit up the Miami Tower, the Seattle Ferris Wheel. It was really great. Patients all over the country got involved. And, you know, it makes patients feel like we're making a difference when we start to really raise awareness. And there are other diseases that have been raising awareness, a lot longer than us. And I've heard people say, you know, raising awareness doesn't really matter, but it does when you have an illness that no one knows about.
Indeed.
So,
they even question the real basis for that disease, whether you know that it is it's a mental disorder or you know psychological problem.
Right.
So relate your own personal experience. You went from being a busy mom and professional to having symptoms.
I was not a mom unless you count my Jack Russell. She's
okay.
Kind of my baby, but
okay.
Oh. Did not have human children.
You get half credit.
But I was an attorney.
Okay.
And married, and you know I live out on Eastern Long Island, and I was snowboarding, and I had a pretty bad concussion, and I didn't feel so great, but I've snowboarded a long time, and I've had a couple of concussions, so I just took it easy the next day. And then I woke up in the second day after, and my one pupil was huge, the other one was small. Hmm. I was shaking. I was
That's interesting. Explain the significance of that, because that is an unusual finding. That really suggests some form of not just a subjective feeling; it's an objective finding that the nerves are
right.
dysregulated. We know that the pupils open and close in relationship to light. But it's weird when one is bigger than the other. That means there's really something wrong with the autonomic circuitry, right?
Right. Well, in my case, it probably was a mild brain injury that I had.
Mm-hmm.
My concussion was so bad. That didn't persist long term, but I did have, I started fainting within a few days of the onset of this, and pretty much every time I stood up, within about 30 seconds to a minute, I would lose my vision.
Hmm.
Because not blindness, but I was like, you know, that gray out that you get before you get a little dizzy and faint. And I didn't know what was going on. I knew something was very wrong, so I ended up in the ER. I ended up in the ER again, you know, and it just kept happening. And I went to my primary care. She sent me to 100 different specialists on Long Island and in New York City, and no one could figure me out. Along the way, I was told, maybe you're not cut out to be a lawyer, you're too stressed at work.
Yeah,
and I
right.
said, but wait, I was fine. I was on vacation when this started. I was told to drink more red wine to relax, and I just was like, I'm so dizzy right now, I couldn't even imagine drinking wine.
Right, right.
And then, anyways, it took about 9 months into it, a big New York City hospital misdiagnosed me with carcinoid, which
does come with
some blood pressure irregularities
and
some of the other symptoms I was having, but they were thankfully wrong because that's a form of cancer, and I didn't have that. But it took 2 months for them to realize that I didn't have it. And then I ended up figuring out myself that I had POTS. And it actually happened because the big hospital in the city had called in a dermatologist, and I was getting all these hives and flushing all the time, which is actually kind of very common in POTS patients. And they called in a dermatologist. She did a skin biopsy on my leg. She was looking for like a mast cell problem, and the pathology report came back and said, well, this biopsy doesn't have a mast cell problem, but this person is missing 80% of their pseudomotor nerve fibers.
Oh.
I didn't know what that was.
Whoa.
So I Googled it right in the hospital, in my hospital bed, in the neurology department at the hospital. And I Googled it, and I found the Vanderbilt University Autonomic Dysfunction Center website. And that was like, jackpot. We found it. Like, they list all the common autonomic disorders and some uncommon ones on their website, and I'm reading this and I'm going, this is what I have.
Wow.
So I pulled some journal articles, thankfully, from I was a science major before I went to law school, so I knew how to do some journal research. I pulled journal articles on POTS, had my husband print them out, brought them to the hospital. I handed it to the neurologist, and I said, I think I have this thing called POTS, but can you look at this and let me know? And of course, like most doctors, he said, don't go on the internet.
Right, right, exactly.
And I said, look, it's Mayo Clinic Journal Proceedings. It's not junk science. Just read this. And he read it, and he came back the next morning and said, wow, you have POTS. So, and then they discharged me because they didn't know what to do for
it.
They didn't
Congratulations, you have this disorder. We don't know what, we now have diagnosis.
Good luck.
That'll be $300, please.
Right.
Right.
And then pretty quickly, I read everything I could on POTS, and I started reading about pseudomotor neuropathy and small fiber neuropathies, which are pseudomotor nerves are the small fiber nerves that control your sweat glands. And
right.
I turned out I had some small fiber sensory stuff going on, too.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, I read everything I could, and I realized pretty quickly that, you know, you should look for the cause of the neuropathy. You shouldn't just, you know, POTS is kind of an idiopathic diagnosis. It's, you know, it's a syndrome of different symptoms that are seen together sometimes. But I knew I had neuropathy, and 50% of POTS patients do have a small fiber neuropathy.
Hmm.
So
that's interesting. I didn't know that there was actually a physical lesion that could be detected on biopsy. I thought it was more diagnosed based on your symptoms or perhaps on a tilt table test. Is that a test that you underwent?
Right. So, yeah, POTS is not diagnosed based on small fiber neuropathy, but it's mm-hmm. just a finding that
a feature of it. Okay, right.
And, yeah. So POTS is diagnosed usually by a tilt table test. Sometimes if that's not available, or in the younger kids, they don't want to tilt them, so they might do a standing test.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have, there are objective diagnostic criteria. You have to have a change in heart rate of 30 beats per minute or more between laying down and standing. So
it gets faster when you stand.
Right, much faster, 30 BPM or more.
That's why it's called POTS, because it's positional orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Is that what it stands for?
Postural orthostatic tachycardia.
Postural. Okay, got it. Okay.
It is positional, so that actually might be
right.
A great acronym. I don't
okay.
know.
P and P, you know, whatever. Yeah, they're the same. Okay.
And you have to not have orthostatic hypotension, which is a very significant blood pressure drop within 3 minutes. So it's a little tricky. The POTS patients, some of them do have blood pressure drops when they stand. Some of them actually have an increase, in, like very abnormal increase in
mm-hmm.
their blood pressure when
mm-hmm.
they stand.
Yep.
Their body's trying to compensate
yep.
for their sort of abnormal blood flow mm-hmm. from their autonomic nerves.
The main thing, though, is it's an inappropriate response to position change. Is the body, you know, I was explaining this to a patient the other day who had fainting and gray outs. It's actually a young man. Pardon me?
I'm sorry, you just cut out for a second.
Oh, okay. I was explaining this to a patient the other day, and he has fainting episodes, and he had these gray outs. And I said, you know, imagine what it's like to be a giraffe if you're lying down on the ground and then you get up. All the changes that have to occur to adapt to that position change if you're 16 feet tall. And a similar thing has to happen when we change position from lying down to standing up. It's an exquisite mechanism, very sensitive. It involves regulation in the caliber of our blood vessels and in our heart rate. And when it's off, like you say, it can be too fast, too slow, too high, too low. It's just off. It's just dysregulated, right?
Right. And POTS patients in particular, they tend to pool blood in the lower half of their body when they stand up. The longer they stand, the more blood, basically gravity pulls the blood down. And in a healthy person, your blood vessels in your legs and your abdomen would constrict
right.
so that the blood would go back to your heart and your brain. But in people who have autonomic dysfunction that affects their blood vessels, like in the lower half of their body, they pool the blood in the lower half, and that causes not enough blood to get to your heart, so your heart starts beating faster, not enough blood to get to your brain, so you can get cognitive impairment, kind of
mm-hmm.
brain fog,
mm-hmm.
Dizziness, lightheadedness, and you can actually kind of gray out your vision. It's not that your eyes don't work, it's just that you're not getting enough blood flow to that part of your brain that controls your vision. Hearing, you can actually get like a little bit of hearing loss while the blood flow problem is happening. And eventually, if it persists long enough, your brain will protect itself by making you faint. And when you faint, you generally end up on the floor, laying down, and the blood flow can be normal again.
Mm.
So
I never looked at it that way. It's actually an adaptive response, is to make you supine. That's interesting.
I don't know if that was by design or not, but that's actually what happens in reality.
Mm-hmm.
You faint, and then eventually you come
mm-hmm.
to, you know,
and
as long as you didn't hit your head too hard.
To a greater or lesser extent, this is also a feature of aging and of certain degenerative diseases, is that people who get older have more difficulty with changing positions.
Cutting
they
out
can't
again.
They can't bound out of bed as with such alacrity as they might have in the past. Correct.
Right. Orthostatic hypotension is actually very common in the elderly population, and it's a frequent cause of falls and injuries that, you know, are a major problem in the elderly. in nursing homes, it's a big issue, especially if people are not getting enough daily exercise. A lack of exercise can make orthostatic symptoms worse, because if you don't have toned legs, your muscles in your legs are part of what helps the blood go back to your upper half of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a major problem in the elderly.
So exercise can be a form of therapy for dysautonomia in certain cases, because if you are used to position change, if your blood vessels and your heart have become responsive to your changes in your states when you're exercising, it's kind of like it stays supple. Your nervous system stays supple and responsive, correct?
Yeah, in some forms of dysautonomia, especially strengthening the leg muscles and the core muscles can really help, return the blood to the upper half of the body. And also just having all of your muscles well-toned will help you use oxygen more efficiently, and, just overall cardiovascular health is helpful. But dysautonomia patients, especially when if they're more on the more disabled end of the spectrum, they have to be careful how they exercise, because you don't want to induce a fainting episode. So you might have to do reclined exercises like a rowing machine or a recumbent bicycle. And swimming is actually one of the best exercises because the water acts like a giant compression stocking and kind of helps keep the pressure on your blood vessels to kind of pump that blood up to your upper half.
Well, that's great, because I do a lot of that. Since dysautonomia it's hard to know when it begins and when it leaves off, could we say that in some ways a very high percentage of Americans suffer from one form or another of dysautonomia? Say, if we define hypertension as a form of dysautonomia, then we would say that almost the majority of people past a certain age have features of dysautonomia, right?
Yeah, I think it depends on how you define it, and different fields and different doctors define it differently. But I tend to think of it as if you have a problem with your autonomic nervous system that is severe enough that it's causing you a disability and impairing your quality of life, then that's what I would call dysautonomia.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a little bit of a twitch in their autonomic nervous system now and then. It's involved. There's hardly any disease that does not somehow involve the autonomic nervous system, from allergies to heart disease to kidney disease. But so it's sort of like, how do you define it? And most doctors would say there are some primary autonomic disorders, POTS, a couple others I could name if you want, multiple system atrophy, familial dysautonomia.
So there's familial dysautonomia suggests there may be a hereditary component, that if you come from a long line of people with these quirks, that this might be passed along.
Familial dysautonomia is an extremely rare inherited disorder that happens in Ashkenazi Jews.
Okay.
And actually, I think 1 out of 27 people are carriers for the mutation, but there's genetic screening now, so people often, if two Ashkenazi Jewish people are getting married, they might get screened beforehand, so they would know. It's a very, very severe form of dysautonomia, and it's present from the time of birth.
Okay. So, and I would also, and having worked with a lot of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, it goes beyond fatigue. It's really like a maladaptation to exertion. And there are some features of dysautonomia. Some patients are, very lightheaded with exertion, they don't mount the proper response to stress.
Right.
So there's a dysautonomia component there, perhaps.
Absolutely. When they recently renamed, they had an Institute of Medicine report where they renamed chronic fatigue syndrome systemic exercise intolerance disease is what they decided to call
right.
it.
Not as catchy.
A lot of controversy amongst some patients and doctors about that name, but whatever they've named it, it certainly has a large component of autonomic dysfunction. And there's some overlap between chronic fatigue syndrome and POTS. In the literature, you can find articles that describe how many POTS patients would qualify for chronic fatigue diagnosis and how many chronic fatigue syndrome patients would qualify for POTS diagnosis. But what I find is most interesting is research is now looking at autoimmunity as a potential mechanism in POTS.
Mm-hmm.
And also in chronic fatigue syndrome, they have found some of the same antibodies in these patients. So that's it's a new area of research, but it's really exciting. And hopefully, you know, provides these patients with new opportunities to treat their illness.
Okay, well, that's a great introduction to the subject of dysautonomia. Our listeners know that we generally pause and resume in part two. So in part two of our discussion with Lauren Stiles from Dysautonomia International, I want to talk a little bit about research, some possible solutions, and give patients some resources for how to scope out the possibility that their condition may be related to dysautonomia. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.